Well, we're still in our new series, It's a Miracle. And we're going to be looking today at some more. Last week we began with the first miracle, as John designates it. And of course that was the turning of water into wine. This morning we're back in John's Gospel for one of the miracles we're going to speak about today, because we're going to speak about two. And the one we're going to be looking at is in John chapter 4. And the other one is recorded by both Luke and Matthew, but we'll come to that in a few minutes' time. And the reason we're looking at these two miracles side by side this morning is because of the things they have in common, which you'll see. But also there are striking contrasts in the two of them. And they are equally interesting and informative. So that's what we'll be doing today. We're looking at two miracles of Jesus side by side. So the first of them is at the end of John chapter 4. So we'll read from verse 45. And when he, that's Jesus, was come into Galilee, the Galileans received him, having seen all the things that he did at Jerusalem at the feast, for they also went unto the feast. So Jesus came again into Cana of Galilee, where he made the water wine. And there was a certain nobleman whose son was sick at Capernaum. When he heard that Jesus was come out of Judea into Galilee, he went unto him and besought him that he would come down and heal his son, for he was at the point of death. Then said Jesus unto him, Except ye see signs and wonders, you will not believe. The nobleman said unto him, Sir, come down, ere my child die. Jesus said unto him, Go thy way, thy son liveth. And the man believed the word that Jesus had spoken unto him, and he went his way. And as he was now going down, his servants met him and told him, saying, Thy son liveth. Then inquired he of them they are, when he began to amend, and they said unto him, Yesterday at the seventh hour the fever left him. So the father knew that it was at the same hour in the which Jesus said unto him, Thy son liveth, and himself believed, and his whole house. Now here's a very human story, isn't it? A loving father who's at his wit's end because his son is seriously ill, and by this time he's at the point of death. We don't know what age the son was. It's almost exclusively the word son that's used throughout here, with one exception, verse 49, he calls him child, so we can assume that he was young. Whether he's 10 months or 10 years, he's still that man's child. He's that man's son, and he's greatly loved. I can't begin to imagine what that father was going through, watching his son deteriorate to a point of passing away. And the feeling of being unable to do anything about it. The father's described as a nobleman. The original just says royal. But no links are made here with any royal names. And that has led some to think that he was perhaps a royal official. Working maybe for Herod. But what I think we can take from it is he's not at the bottom of society. Therefore he wouldn't be short of a bob or two. And I'm sure he probably outlaid as much as he possibly could to try and get a cure for his son. And that would have failed. And here we find him desperate. John 4 and 47 tells us that the father heard that Jesus was in the Galilee area. A few verses earlier we read that the Galileans were excited to welcome Jesus, because a number of them had been at the Feast of Passover in Jerusalem and they had seen him in action there. In fact, John mentions this back in chapter 2 and verse 23, where he says, And when Jesus was at Jerusalem at the Passover and the feast, many believed in his name and saw the miracles which he did. Or the original word there for miracles, as we mentioned before, is signs. Now, whether the nobleman was present or not, it may have been that he couldn't tear himself away from the sight of his sick son. We just don't know. But many did make the pilgrimage and they came back talking about what Jesus had done, what Jesus had said, his actions. And he hears. And suddenly there's a ray of hope in his otherwise cloud-filled sky. And so, with this glimmer of hope, he leaves his home in Capernaum and goes in search of Jesus. And somehow their paths cross at Cana, where Jesus had performed the miracle we talked about last week. That's 20 plus miles of a journey from Capernaum to Cana. It's thought that to walk that distance would take between 7 and 8 hours. Well, if he started at sunrise, then he would have arrived in Cana around 1 o'clock. And of course, that's the seventh hour. And in our reading there, that was when the boy was healed. Now, if he got to speak directly to Jesus when he arrived in Cana, and Jesus spoke the words that he did and assured him, your child's living, and then he made his way back immediately, he may well have been back just before sundown or just after sundown in Capernaum. And of course, sundown marks the beginning of the new day. You know that whenever the Jews celebrate Shabbat, Sabbath, they don't do it on Saturday morning. They begin on Friday night. So each new day begins with an evening and morning. And that's how they mark these things. So it may well be that he came back after sundown, speaking to the people from the village or the friends who came out to meet him. And by their reckoning, it's now the next day. And he says, when did he amend? Started to go and amend at 1 o'clock. That was exactly the time that Jesus had mentioned. Go thy way, Jesus said. And he went his way. So there's every reason to think that he did. He put an inch to his step. He went there and then, rather than waiting over the night, as some would have us to believe. Well, what a miracle. What an answer to that man's prayers. What a turnaround in that man's situation. But that's just one of the miracles. Here's the second one. Luke chapter 7. I should have thrown it out there. Could anybody guess what the other miracle might be that I would be tying up? But now you're there. The plot is out. And it's, of course, the healing of the centurion's servant. So Luke chapter 7 from the first verse. And when Jesus had ended all of his sayings in the audience of the people, he entered into, Capernaum. And a certain centurion's servant who was dear unto him was sick and ready to die. And when the centurion heard of Jesus, he sent unto him the elders of the Jews, beseeching him that he would come and heal his servant. And when they came to Jesus, they besought him instantly, saying that he was worthy for whom he should do this. Again, mentioning the centurion there. And here's the reason they give. For he loveth our nation and hath built us a synagogue. Then Jesus went with them, and when he was now not far from the house, the centurion sent friends to him, saying unto him, Lord, trouble not thyself, for I am not worthy that thou shouldst enter under my roof. Wherefore neither thought I myself worthy to come unto thee. But say in a word, and my servant shall be healed. For I also am a man set under authority, having under me soldiers. And I say unto one, go, and he goeth, and to another, come, and he cometh, and to my servant, do this, and he doeth it. When Jesus heard these things, he marveled at him and turned him about and said unto the people that followed him, I say unto you, I have not found so great faith, no, not in Israel. And if you nip over to Matthew chapter 8, where we have Matthew's account, Matthew leaves out the fact that the centurion used the Jewish elders to approach Jesus. That's the difference there. But he still includes this phrase, verse 10 of Matthew 8, I have not found so great faith, no, not in Israel. And then Matthew adds this, and I say unto you, this is Jesus speaking, that many shall come from the east and west and shall sit down with Abraham and Isaac and Jacob in the kingdom of heaven, but the children of the kingdom shall be cast out into outer darkness. There shall be weeping and gnashing of teeth. And Jesus said unto the centurion, go thy way, As thou hast believed, so be it unto thee. And his servant was healed in the selfsame hour. What have we in this second healing? Well, we have a concerned employer, a Roman centurion, a man over 100 soldiers. His concerns were for the well-being of a very dear and faithful servant. He maybe looked on him as being indispensable. But now he's seriously ill. At the end of verse 2, we read he's about to die. So here's a Gentile, non-Jewish man, another man with money and with contacts. But he had been unable to use them to fight the illness that was about to claim the life of his faithful servant. He too hears about Jesus, beginning of verse 3. And that's not surprising because the centurion seems to have an interest, an extraordinary interest in Judaism. And that would of course include what the Jewish people are talking about. What's the big thing in Judaism at the minute? And of course the big thing was that Jesus had appeared on the scene. Who is this person? The centurion has a close relationship with the Jews at Capernaum. They think highly of him, and they really should, because he donated a synagogue for their worship. And that's incredible. We read of many building projects, don't we, of Herod the Great and of the Caesars, and the remains of many of these are still in Israel to this day. But Capernaum is one of my favourite places to visit when we go to Israel, because it hadn't been continuously populated over the years, and therefore it just lay hidden under the sand for centuries, meaning it could be excavated now, and we can see so much in the ruins of Capernaum. But here's the thing. There's an amazing synagogue there, ruins of, still there, at Capernaum. It's called the White Synagogue, and that's because all the other buildings were made of brown basalt, but they shipped in the white limestone to build that synagogue. However, it's slightly later than the one that the centurion built, but believed to be on the foundations of the one that the centurion built. And that's an amazing place to visit, because you really get a sense that Jesus was there, because Jesus spoke in that synagogue. Miracles happened there in Capernaum, and it is a very precious place to visit. And it's a link with this man, this real man, who provided a place of worship as a Gentile for his Jewish friends in the town. Now, that's very good, but whilst it's interesting, it's also a wee bit troubling when I read about his interaction with the Jews in this story, even though it's just a couple of wee mentions, a very short story, because I detect a wee problem. It seems to me that the centurion had become over-reliant on the opinions and the control of the elders of the Jews. In spite of his generosity to them, they seem to still be keeping him at arm's length. And you get the sense that he feels inferior as a Gentile, of course being an outsider. And therefore he sends his Jewish acquaintances to this Jewish miracle worker called Jesus, rather than go himself. But despite this barrier, the centurion is convinced that if Jesus is who he claims to be, then Jesus' word won't be limited by religious protocols or walls or doors either. And it's the centurion's trust in the power of the commanding word of Jesus that grabs Jesus' attention. And upon realizing the rare faith of the centurion, the Lord speaks the word. His servant is healed instantly without Jesus actually coming into direct contact with the patient. Now, in the Gospels, we read of many times when people were astonished at what Jesus said and astonished at what Jesus did. But this is a rare occasion, because we read that Jesus is amazed. He marvels. He's astonished at this centurion. A remarkable person. So two miracles, and I'm sure by now you have in your mind And maybe you're scribbling down notes. You have a list of similarities between the two stories. Because in both stories, there's a person who's sick. And the sick people, sick boy, sick man, in each case, is at Capernaum. So they have that in common. And Capernaum was one of the most privileged places outside of Jerusalem to witness the power of Jesus during his earthly ministry. In fact, Jesus said in Matthew 11, verse 23, "Thou Capernaum, which are exalted unto heaven, shall be brought down to hell. For if the mighty works which have been done in thee had been done in Sodom, it would have remained until this day." And Jesus meant what he said there. If. "But I say unto you, that it shall be more tolerable for the land of Sodom in the day of judgment than for thee." That's Capernaum. What else had they in common? Well, both of the patients were about to die, ready to die, and at the point of death. Both of them were cherished. There's no doubt about this. The nobleman loved his son, and the centurion had a deep regard for his servant. They couldn't contemplate life going forward without the presence of, in the nobleman's case, his son, and in the centurion's case, that particular servant. Both stories, the person who intercedes, the nobleman and centurion, both of them approached Jesus on the behalf of the sick person. So there was no direct contact. But they approached Jesus on behalf of the sick person. And in the centurion's case, he even goes through the Jewish elders as well. And both of the people who were sick were healed instantly. So those are the things that they have in common. So you can see why I've chosen to speak on these and look at them side by side. Remarkable similarities. But then there are differences, and they are equally interesting. And maybe it's the differences that are what we should look at today and see, well, what's the Lord showing us here through these differences? Maybe the fact that there are so many similarities is the bait to draw us in and make us think about the differences. Well, the most obvious one is, of course, the nobleman is a Jew and the centurion a non-Jew or a Gentile. And in some places, the word Greek is used to speak of a non-Jew. The nobleman was father to the sick boy. The centurion, on the other hand, was a master to the sick servant. So there's differences. The nobleman went to Jesus and said, "Come down from Cana to Capernaum and heal my son." The centurion sent others to Jesus with the same idea, but he modifies his request as Jesus approaches the house and says, "Trouble not the master. I don't expect them to come under the roof of a Gentile." So there are differences. Here's a difference. The nobleman calls Jesus, "Sir." The centurion calls him, "Lord." And in the story of the nobleman's son, Jesus has very testing words for the nobleman. But in the story of the centurion and his servant, Jesus has nothing but praise for this Gentile. And then when he finishes what he says, as we read in Matthew's Gospel, he then turns with very testing words to the descendants of Abraham who were watching on. So what's the point of all this? Well, I believe the two accounts serve to highlight something. And probably the primary thing, the main thing to take from these stories, the main thing that stands out is that Jesus came to his own people looking for something. I wonder if Jesus were to come to the Monkstown Assembly as he did to the seven churches of Revelation that we've been thinking about recently. What does he come looking for? And one of the clues is in Matthew 8 at the end of verse 10. "I have not found, so If looking for something, I have not found so great faith, no, not in Israel. So in his interactions with the Jewish people, his own people, up to this point, he had been looking. And it's now when he's speaking to those who represent the centurion, and they get his message and his thoughts and his reply to Jesus, that Jesus is amazed at the response of this Gentile, because he does find in him what he was looking for in Israel. Jesus today is looking for our faith, our complete trust, our belief in him. Wonder, does he find that? Or are we the people who, when we come to pray, as I've mentioned before, I've heard it so many times, we start to pray and we mention Willie. And, oh, Lord, you know Willie. And we go over all the reasons why Willie's situation is hopeless. And you know what, Willie's this and Willie's that. And then, you know, Lord, we've spoke to Willie many times, and we've dragged Willie to meetings. And Willie's been, and Willie had a great heritage. His mother and father went to the gospel. And on we go. And we tell God all the reasons why Willie's not saved at the minute, and why Willie may never be saved, instead of coming as if it was the first time and just saying, Lord, there's a soul. You died for him. Save him. Does he find that kind of faith and belief and trust in us? And we can extend that not just to us praying for an unsaved person, but you know the situations that you're going through in your life. That's why Jesus said in John 4:48 to this anxious nobleman whose son was dying, except you see signs and wonders, you will not believe. Makes sense, doesn't it? When you contrast it with the story of the centurion's servant. And that was so true, because Jesus wrought many signs and wonders amongst the people in their midst. And the more he did, and the more he did in public, and the more the people flocked to hear Jesus and to follow Jesus, and they did in their thousands, as you know, 5,000 in one occasion. The more Jesus worked and performed these signs and miracles, the more his own people, at least the leaders, the religious leaders, all leaders, the elders of the people, the more they turned from him and determined to reject him and planned to get rid of him. Earlier in John's Gospel, when I read that verse to you, when Jesus was at Jerusalem at the Passover and the feast day, many believed in his name because of the signs and miracles that he did. But here's what we read, just the next few lines. But Jesus did not commit himself unto them, because he knew all men, and needed not that any should testify of man, for he knew what was in man. So what appeared to be a response, Jesus knew. Jesus knew what was really in their heart. Even then, even having seen, even having brought the news back and talked about it when they got back to Galilee, he knew what was in their heart. Paul says in 1 Corinthians 1:22, for the Jews require a sign, the Greeks, that's another word for the Gentiles, seek after wisdom, but we preach Christ crucified. Unto the Jews a stumbling block, to the Greeks foolishness, but unto them which are called both Jews and Greeks, Christ, the power of God and the wisdom of God. And that's a verse that links these two stories in my mind. One man, according to Jesus, or he wouldn't have said what he said, the nobleman, he is there. Yes, he's there looking for Jesus to heal his son, absolutely, and Jesus heals his son. But in his mind, Jesus detects he's looking for a sign. Whereas here is a centurion, a Roman, a Gentile. And he has grasped something. Christ, the power of God and the wisdom of God. The Jewish nobleman leaves believing, and when he gets back to Capernaum and sees his son well, we read there again, he and his house believe. So he leaves believing. I believe the centurion approached Jesus, believing. Are we the type of people that only leave believing? Or are we the type of people who approach Jesus believing? What did the centurion believe that set him apart from the majority of the Jews in Jesus' day? Think about, again in John's Gospel, just a few paragraphs before what we read in chapter 4. John chapter 3, Nicodemus. He comes to Jesus by night. But think of what he says in his opening statements. He says, Rabbi, teacher, we know that you're a teacher come from God. You know, that's a very limiting statement really, isn't it? We know you're a teacher. Because remember, Nicodemus is a ruler of the Jews. And he's saying, we know you're a teacher come from God. There are others who were happy to see Jesus as a prophet. To maybe even question, is this Elijah? And they did. Remember how Elijah and Elisha performed many miracles. So you can see where they were coming from in that. But again, limiting. A prophet, yes. Teacher, prophet. But it's a very different thing to accept and believe and completely embrace that Jesus is the power of God and the wisdom of God. Jesus is not only the Son of God, but God the Son. Jesus is God revealed and manifested in human form. Jesus is Emmanuel, God with us. John, in writing his gospel, the whole purpose in writing is given in chapter 20, verse 30. And many other signs truly did Jesus in the presence of his disciples, which are not written in this book. But these are written that ye might believe that Jesus is the Christ. That's fine. And that believing ye might have life through his name. Did I quote the whole verse? Well, a good guess would be no, because you know me by now. I'll leave bits out to test you. Here's what verse 31 of John 20 actually says. But these are written that ye might believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God. And that believing ye might have life through his name. John opens the gospel with these words. In the beginning was the Word. The Word was with God and the Word was God. Whenever we go back to the book of Genesis to check up on that, what do we read? We read there, and God said, let there be light. And God said, and God said, the power of the living Word, the person, the Word. These are things that we can see in this centurion. Whether he understood everything as fully as I'm explaining it to you or not, we don't know. But he had a grasp that others didn't have. The very fact that he would say, just speak the word. Where did he get that from? Isn't it interesting that the very first sin began with a seed of doubt? The serpent comes to Eve and says, has God said? And isn't it interesting that it has to do with what God said? So the centurion comes believing, and he has an amazing grasp, a faith in who Jesus is and what Jesus can do, and that Jesus can speak the word, even though he's not even present in the room with the sick person. The centurion uses his own language to describe his confidence, and that's what impresses and amazes and makes Jesus marvel, because he says, there's a chain of command. I'm a man under a commander. And it's thought that at that particular time, the person who would have been the commander over the armies and over the centurion would probably have been living in luxury at Caesarea Maritime, and that's some 50 miles away from where the centurion was living. So orders would have reached him from a distance. So there's that idea. But then he in turn was over 100 men. So he would have been giving orders to those 100 men as well. And he would expect them to obey. And in his mind, he sees this chain of command in the earthly ministry of Jesus. Jesus, of course, is yielded to the Father's will while he's here in human form on this earth. He does always the things that please the Father. He is the express image of God. So there's a sense also in which he's revealing the Father. My Father works and I work. God was in Christ reconciling the world unto himself. So there's a lot about that we don't understand. But one thing is for sure, God is sovereign over all in heaven or earth, things seen or things unseen. And Jesus is described by the centurion as Lord. The nobleman used the word sir. Lord. Now that's a big thing to say, isn't it? Maybe us as believers here today, maybe we use the word Lord too easily. Because perhaps we're only using it in one sense. We're using it in the sense that we know he is Lord of all. That'll never change. So he'll always be able to be addressed as Lord with that in mind. But what about this chain of command we're talking about? What about Jesus being Lord of my life and Lord of yours? This centurion, from the few words we have recorded for us, has such a grasp of things that Jesus was amazed. If Jesus is who he says he is, then if he can speak the world into being, he can say to my servant, be healed. And my servant will be healed. What faith? Jesus one day stood up in a boat and said to a storm, be still. What happened? There was a great calm. Do you need Jesus to speak that into your life today? Do you need him to say, be still? He can. Do you believe he can? Do you need a miracle? Is there somebody that you care for deeply? You're here. They're not. You would love them to be here. You're concerned about that person. They may be ill. Maybe something else. Maybe the Lord's asking you today, do you believe? Or do you need to be reminded through this story of who I am? Do you need to be reminded that God can speak the word that can transform the situation that you find yourself in? I've used this wee illustration before, and we are talking about revival on Tuesday nights, and we're looking over the instances of it and the histories of revival to encourage our hearts. And I hope some of you that are coming out on Tuesday night are encouraged by what we've been discussing. But we'll eventually get to the Hebridean revival some of these nights. And here's a wee instance of concerned parents praying for a wayward son. And it's, of course, the great Duncan Campbell, who was used in the revival of 49. On a December night in 1913, Duncan was playing the bagpipes at a concert and dance. And he was billed to demonstrate his skill at sword dancing. Now, you have to understand that in that setting, and in the Hebrides, that was a terribly worldly thing to be doing. And while he was playing the green hills of Tyrol, he suddenly found himself thinking about the cross. And he was seized with conviction of sin. He looked around him at the audience and he just thought, is this all life has to offer? So here he is, he's the star attraction, he's the top of the bill in this concert, in this dance hall. And he's looking around him and saying, is this all life has to offer? And that drove him that after he was finished, he made a hasty exit from the dance hall. And it was late. And yet, when he went past the little hall where he had attended Sunday school, he noticed that the light was on. And as he walked up to the door of the hall, he was under conviction of sin, he heard his own father praying. Then after he had heard his father pray, this was an after meeting, this is late into the night, the Faith Mission pilgrims that were there, one of them decided to get up and pass on a wee word, because Duncan was now listening. And he's preached in Job 33, God speaketh once, yea twice. Duncan Campbell was so convicted he had to run out of the hall because he was trembling that much. He thought, I'm going to make a scene here. And as he headed home, he was surprised to find another light on because it's now 2 o'clock in the morning. And he found his mother on her knees, praying for him. Praying for him. She would have gone to the meetings, but visitors arrived, and actually she had put them up in Duncan's bedroom. And she says, go out into the barn and don't come in until you're right with God. Their sons in the world. They're praying. God sends conviction into the dance hall. And Duncan comes home and gets saved. And what a salvation. And what a testimony. You pray, but believe that the very minute you're praying, God could be answering your prayer, no matter where you are or where that person is. The self same are. God can step in. Believe him and expect